The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, after 25 years of stumping scientists, a mysterious mollusk found drifting in the ocean off the coast of California has been identified. We'll learn more about this unusual animal. And we'll learn about how human practices can both contribute to and help prevent wildfires. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. About 25 years ago, deep in the ocean off the coast of California, scientists discovered a mysterious creature. The animal, nearly invisible, except for its bioluminescence, stumped researchers. More than two decades later, scientists now know what the animal is, a nudibranch, or sea slug, although it doesn't look like other sea slugs. And its nickname, the mystery mollusk, has stuck. To learn more about this unusual creature, I spoke with Bruce Robison, senior scientist and midwater ecologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute.
It sort of looks like something cobbled together from spare parts left over from other animals. At one end, there's this big, voluminous, bowl-shaped hood. In the middle is a sort of a rounded mid-body that has the digestive organs and reproductive organs, and below that is a sort of cylindrical foot that sticks down, and at the opposite end from the hood is a sort of flat tail that has about a dozen finger-like projections sticking out from it. You put all those pieces together and you have a strange-looking critter that we found fascinating, and we wanted to learn as much about it as we could.
Where in the ocean, at what depth, is this mystery mollusk found, and why is it so hard to find? Besides being down deep below the ocean, I guess.
Right. It lives in the water column. It lives in that enormous, vast volume of water between the sea surface and the deep sea floor. On a global average, that's about 4,000 meters deep. The mystery mollusk lives principally between about 1,000 meters depth and 3,000 meters depth, although we have seen them on the sea floor, which is where they go to spawn. And they are rare in that We needed almost 20 years in order to accumulate enough observations to do a really comprehensive description of the animal. They are, we believe, probably more widespread than just the ones we've seen here off Monterey. There are reports of a similar animal from the mid-Pacific and from the Western Pacific as well. I won't say reports. Actually, they were video frames that had been posted online that we recognized as the critter we were working on, although the folks who were recording those images, like us at first, had no idea what they were looking at.
So the mystery mollusk spends its day drifting around in the deep ocean. Is it unusual to find sea slugs suspended in the water column like that? Where are nudibranchs usually found?
Nudibranchs are most commonly known from shallow water in tide pools and kelp forests and all sorts of subtidal regions. And many of them, if not most of them, are animals that live on the bottom. They feed on sponges and other kinds of attached animals. They are often brightly colored with surprising external structure. They are kind of tough-bodied and fairly well-muscled. The mystery mollusk has moved into a different habitat, and in order to cope with the challenges of living in that truly three-dimensional habitat of the water column, they've had to shed a lot of weight, and indeed they're pretty much neutrally buoyant. And to do that, they have diminished the degree of musculature that they have, and they've through evolution, they have adapted to that habitat by becoming lighter in weight and transparent in the process. Transparency confers invisibility, if you will, in those deep waters, and helps them to avoid predators by making it really difficult to spot them. They are grossly different from all the other nudibranchs we know about, not only because of their shape and size and coloration, but also where they live. There are a few nudibranch species known to live on the deep sea floor down 3,000-4,000 meters deep, and there are a few that are known to live up near the very surface of the ocean. But no nudibranchs had ever been discovered in that vast region between the surface and the deep sea floor before we came across this one.
Why is the identification of the mystery mollusk so exciting? I understand it took a long time and it's an unusual animal, but what in particular about this makes you so excited?
Well, it reinforces the notion that we have only begun to scratch the surface of what exists out there in the world ocean. Monterey Bay and the adjacent deep waters are probably the best studied patch of deep ocean in the whole world. And yet, even after 30 years at Mabari, we're still discovering new stuff. That reinforces the fact that the rest of the world's ocean, which has been virtually unexplored, must hold an extraordinary range of different kinds of animals, showing different adaptations and different behavior patterns and ecological interactions. One of the most exciting things to me about this discovery is that it's an indication of how much else there is out there yet to be discovered. I find that exciting because if we can't even imagine what the other animals, the undiscovered animals may look like or how important they are in the ecology of the ocean, that means that there's a lot of excitement and fun to be had. Because to me, this kind of exploration and discovery is exciting and it's fun. It also has significance in that it shows us that there are many, many more steps or links in the oceanic food web than we had ever imagined. We rely on the ocean for a good portion of our food, we humans, and yet the species that we consume depend on a wide range of other species that are all tied up into an intricate and complex food web that allows for the production of species that we harvest commercially and consume. And if we're going to live on this planet and live harmoniously with the planet, we really need to understand everything that's out there. We need to learn who else lives there and how they all fit together in communities and what kinds of ecological interactions are involved. Otherwise, we're liable to make mistakes about how we exploit the resources that humans need. Unintended consequences of harvesting both animal and plant resources, as well as mining and exploitation of non-living resources, always has consequences. But if we don't know who's there, we can't predict what the consequences might be. And in some cases, the consequences will come back and bite us on the butt because we didn't know enough to prevent a bad result of our exploitation.
Bruce Robeson is senior scientist and midwater ecologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. While wildfires are common in the western U.S., dry conditions and warm temperatures helped fuel an unusual autumn wildfire season in northeastern states. But how much do we know about wildfires? And how does human development have a role in contributing to or preventing wildfires? To learn more, The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Stephanie Pincel, a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA, and director of the Institute's California Center for Sustainable Communities.
If we roll back the calendar probably a couple hundred years or more, indigenous peoples in the United States used fire to manage vegetation for enhanced grazing for ungulates that they hunted, also to enhance the kinds of vegetation that they collected for food sources. And so the landscapes that Westerners, colonialists, inherited were highly managed landscapes. Coming from Europe, though, where the landscapes had been managed and looked very, very different than the managed landscapes here, they assumed that indigenous peoples did nothing, that they were just, you know, reaping the bounties of the planet without managing the bounties of the planet. And so they excluded fire because they saw fire as a threat to resources. So indigenous peoples practiced, if you wish, controlled burning. That, over the past hundred years, was excluded from landscapes in the United States completely by the Forest Service and by prevailing ideology that forests were good and you needed as many as you as possible, particularly after the Westerners had cut a lot of them down. So what has happened is, in the view of some, many in fact, there's been an overabundance of forests. The trees are weakened because they don't have enough light, they don't have enough water, they're in great competition with one another for both of those nutrient sources. So the idea is if we reintroduce fire into the landscapes, we will have healthier forests, healthier vegetation, and less prone landscapes because we'll have less dry brush and the trees will be healthier, so they will be less prone to burning. So that's called, you know, developing controlled burns. That is to say, you go in and you burn in a careful manner and establish buffers and try to introduce fires that are not really, really, really hot and out of, you know, very fire, wind driven and so forth. You burn on days where there's low wind and maybe higher humidity, so it's easier to control where the flames are going.
As we know that there are many people that are negatively affected by wildfires. So I want to know what communities and homes are more susceptible to wildfire damage and why.
The suburban developments that have occurred over the past you know, probably 30 years out farther and farther from the urban core are the areas that are the most fire prone. They were not built, the housing itself was not built to withstand or mitigate fire, like having closed eaves and no highly flammable vegetation right around the house and materials that are less flammable. None of that was put in place because we simply ignored the problem or didn't even realize there was a problem. So the people who have essentially bought places, you know, drive till you afford the can afford the mortgage, are the ones that are the most vulnerable. They drive the farthest, they live in the most flammable neighborhoods. The streets are not necessarily aligned to make for efficient evacuation or firefighting, and the vegetation is simply ill-adapted to the new fire regime. So essentially, the people who have the least amount of choice, generally speaking, are the ones who live the farthest out and are the ones that are most vulnerable.
In California, how much does urban, rural, and ex-urban development play in wildfires?
100%.
Does this also apply to other places around the country?
I suspect so, although I'm a Californiaist, so I would not be expert in other places. But if you're building in highly vegetated areas that are on the urban fringe, where there's forest or other kinds of open vegetated areas, and it is getting hotter and warmer, the likelihood is that they will be more susceptible to fire in periods where there's no rain, logically speaking.
How is climate change and this urban development into wild areas making wildfires increasingly common? Is climate change a big factor in increasing these wildfires as well?
That's always a very tricky question. People like to point the finger at climate change as a kind of independent variable, but you can't. Climate change, first of all, climate change is created by human activity, right? Mm-hmm. The burning of fossil fuels. So in any event, however you want to frame the question, these are human-induced situations. So that's one. Two, if there was no human ignition, which in California accounts for quite a high proportion of the fires, you would not have the fires. So arson, one of the more recent fires was caused by some person pushing a car that was on fire down a canyon. And the whole thing blew up, right? There was an enormous fire after that. Another fire here in the, kind of in my backyard in the interior of LA County was caused by an arsonist. And so, you know, it's easy to say it's climate change, but actually most of the fires, many of the fires are caused by people doing things. So throwing your cigarette butt out the window, having a lawnmower with a poor spark arrestor, arson itself. Any number of these things that seem trivial in a time where there's the vegetation is very dry will cause a big fire, particularly if there are these high winds, the Santa Ana winds in Southern California, which just drive embers, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet away farther out, and there's very little to do to combat it. It's very difficult to combat it. So to say that it's climate change, yes, in a certain way, it certainly is climate change. It is human-induced, the climate change, and many of the fires are created by people in those places that are very vulnerable to fire doing unthoughtful things, shall we say. And the more we expand into those areas, and people do those things, the more there will be fires.
I would love for you to explain the risks it is to build in fire-prone areas. And is there a way to protect them as well?
The best way to protect them is not to build there. And, you know, if you want to protect those buildings, they will cost more to build. There's no question about it. We have to make some choices. Fire protection at the building level is very expensive. Fire protection at the community level, that is firefighting, is extremely expensive. The building of places on the urban periphery has external costs that are poorly accounted for. You know, more infrastructure that goes out there, the county or the city ends up paying for, even if the developer builds it. You know, more commuting, so more greenhouse gas emissions, and or the need to, you know, mine more lithium for more cars. I mean, we're really not building appropriately for the climate that we have created. And many of those buildings are not really situated in places where the high impacts of high heat will be mitigated by the way the building is built. So you need more energy for air conditioning, right? It's a kind of big set of consequences of being attached to this idea that we can live these kind of semi-rural lifestyles without really making a commitment to being semi-rural. We want all the amenities of living in the city, but out there in some kind of semi-rural paradise, which is highly flammable and has all these other consequences.
Does aging infrastructure, I mean, even aging electrical infrastructure, pose any major risks to contributing to wildfires? And if so, is there any way to fix it?
Ooh, that's a really big question. great question. I like that question. Thank you. The utilities, I can speak about California because, again, this is the place I live and the place I know. The investor-owned utilities, the privately owned utilities, have had a track record that's been well documented that over the past 20 years, I would say, maybe even a little bit more, the emphasis has been to increase shareholder revenue. And that has come at the expense of investing in infrastructure maintenance. So the big Paradise fire, where the city of Paradise burned down and a bunch of people died up in Northern California, was caused by the failure of a metal hook that held the wires up above the forest canopy. That hook had been manufactured in about 1920 and had not been replaced. That's because, one, the utility decided that it did not really need to invest in making sure the infrastructure was maintained. And interestingly enough, two, they didn't really believe that there was the problem of climate change at all at the time. So they didn't feel it was necessary to go out and make sure that the wires were not hanging over trees and so on and so forth. So the fact is that these utilities have old infrastructure, and what they are now doing is charging the ratepayers higher fees in order to spend the money to refurbish and harden the infrastructure. And they are intending to build many, many more transmission lines because we're building centralized solar and wind farms in order to increase the renewable portfolios of, you know, in general. Now, there is a better alternative, in my opinion, and that is the distributed energy resource approach. The distributed energy resource approach means that you're generating your electricity much closer to where you are serving it. Rooftop solar, microgrids, community solar facilities, and so on, where you shorten the transmission needed and really generate closer to where the clients are. And you couple that with a lot of investment in battery storage to overcome the intermittency problem because the sun doesn't shine in the middle of the night. So, yes, there are a very valid and very well thought out alternatives, but they don't suit the business model of the utility quite so well.
Do you believe there are any policy changes that are needed to prevent wildfires?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of policies, actually, that accumulate, right? So one is to expand the use of controlled burning, which is a science and a skill that we are not super well practiced at. So we need to really learn how to do this well. And we need to understand that it's going to be expensive and it's going to take a long time. So we don't blink an eye when there's a fire at how much money it takes to fight that fire. And it takes a lot of money. And that is, these are kind of like special appropriations because it absolutely needs to be done. The money it requires to do the controlled burning is much harder to get. You know, prevention is always harder than, you know, the emergency. We need to be able to spend the money it takes and the time it takes to do the controlled burning, and we need to educate people about good fire. There is good fire. So that's one big policy area, and it's going to require, you know, kind of new forest science, new prairie science, new ecosystem management science, because it's not all forests that burn. It's prairies, it's chaparral, it's other kinds of vegetation, including, you know, northern boreal forests, right? So we have to learn how to manage those better than we have, pay more attention to specificity and how indigenous peoples manage those places too. The other thing that I think is really, really going to have to be a policy is a very serious fire hazard assessment process in the process of approving new land developments. And if there is a high likelihood of fire flammability, those places simply should not be built. Otherwise, it's costing everybody a lot of money, and there's an enormous amount of heartbreak, and the insurance companies are increasingly saying, no, we're not going to insure there, right? So that it causes trauma if we're not able to say no and to redirect investment into places where there's less likelihood of being exposed to hazards.
Stephanie Pincel is a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA and director of the Institute's California Center for Sustainable Communities. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1782. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.